KRWG News this week. I'm Fred Martino. Thanks for being with us. The New Mexico legislature this week approved a $330 million economic relief package aimed at helping unemployed workers and certain businesses that have been hit hard by the coronavirus pandemic. Passage came Tuesday night as lawmakers rushed to wrap up a one-day session that was called by Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham. The state will distribute $1,200 stimulus checks to people who are unemployed. Most of the proposed spending will be made possible by federal relief funding previously assigned to New Mexico. Without a second federal stimulus plan, New Mexico Democrats are pleased with the legislature's actions, but they're also promoting long-term solutions in the January session, like the new revenue they say could be generated by the legalization of marijuana. With more, here's Madison Staten.
Second vice chair of the Democratic Party of Doña Ana County, Kat Sanchez, says it showcases the dedication of state elected officials to step up in the absence of a federal stimulus package.
They are looking at trying to secure an economy for New Mexico and trying to make sure that everybody has food on their table and is able to pay their rent or their mortgage. Days before we get together around a table for Thanksgiving, our legislators are working hard to make sure that we can continue to feed, clothe, and shelter our families. And I think that speaks volumes that we can come together, put things aside, and just make sure that we're doing right by our communities.
Sanchez suggested one pathway to greater economic prosperity is for the state to consider legalizing marijuana. She says it's a way for the state to stay competitive in the agricultural industry, especially with neighboring states like Arizona and Colorado, who have already legalized marijuana.
I think it has no choice but to pass. Not only is it an economic boost for our state, let's face it, as much as we rely on oil, that is a finite amount in our state. We can't rely on that for our future generations, for our kids. So we do have to diversify. So that's the first aspect. But now we are bordered by two states, Arizona and Colorado, who have legalized. And that means that we have to, as an agricultural state, be ready to compete with these other states who are going to move in on that. And if agriculture is such a big part of our state, we have to stay competitive, period.
Lieutenant Governor Howie Morales also says that legalization would greatly benefit the state.
There's some benefits that even go beyond the revenue that they'll bring in. But I do think that there's other benefits that can go in place. And I think that New Mexico is at the point where we're going to make this a reality. And I look forward to seeing that.
Chair of the Democratic Party of Doña Ana County, Mona Tremp, says other top priorities of the New Mexico legislature need to include getting the virus under control and helping to provide tools to get education back on track.
We can't risk losing a generation of kids with interrupted education. There were enough challenges as, you know, before the pandemic. And so I think we all have to work very, very hard.
Sanchez is hopeful the new presidential administration will help to foster greater economic recovery and unification, but says unification must also come from inside the state.
I think the best way to unite a country isn't just one answer, isn't just one way. I think that one facet of moving forward would have to be the example that a new administration would set. But this is also something that we can't just lay at the feet of a new administration. Other facets include all of us. We know that we come together when the chips are down, when we need one another, when we need help. And we need to rely on that aspect of what we are as New Mexicans. And we can't just wait for another administration to do this for us. This is work that we all have to do in our houses, among our family circle, as a community.
For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
As you just heard, a lot of New Mexicans talking about the potential legalization of marijuana in the state. The legislature has failed despite a number of chances during previous legislative sessions. We'll look ahead to January to see what happens in New Mexico. We may also be hearing about attempts in Texas. Some legislators are proposing the legalization of marijuana in the Lone Star State As Jerry Clayton reports, one of those legislators is El Paso's Joe Moody.
Several bills have been filed for the next Texas legislative session that would decriminalize or legalize the use of marijuana in the state.
Because it's far past time to let grown adults living in a free state decide what's appropriate for them.
That's Joe Moody, El Paso State Representative and Speaker Pro Tem of the Texas House. Moody has filed House Bill 447, which calls for legalization of marijuana and would allow the retail sale in Texas.
Adults are soon going to be able to walk into stores throughout Texas and make safe, legal purchases of cannabis.
Moody says House Bill 447 would allow the state to tax cannabis products at 10%, with the revenue going to cities, counties, and the teacher retirement system. A 2019 survey reported that about 54% of Texans supported the legalization of marijuana. Moody spoke Friday during the Texas Marijuana Policy Conference. I'm Jerry Clayton in San Antonio.
Well, another local story that is in the national spotlight is Homeland Security, and particularly the U.S.-Mexico border. It's been one of the most contentious areas of the Trump presidency. This week, President-elect Biden announced his choice for Homeland Security Secretary would be the first person of Hispanic descent to lead the department. Here is Alejandro Mayorkas.
Mr. President-elect, Madam Vice President-elect, thank you for placing your trust in me to lead the Department of Homeland Security. Thank you for the privilege of returning with the consent of the Senate to government service as a member of your administration. It is the honor of a lifetime. The Department of Homeland Security has a noble mission to help keep us safe and to advance our proud history as a country of welcome. There are more than 240,000 career employees who selflessly dedicate their talent and energy to this mission. Many risk their lives in doing so. I would be honored to return to the department and support these dedicated public servants in fulfilling their responsibilities and realizing our country's greatest hopes, all in partnership with the communities we serve. For 12 years, I had the privilege to stand in a federal courtroom and announce Alejandro Mayorkas on behalf of the United States of America. The words "on behalf of the United States of America" meant everything to me and to my parents, whom I think of today and every day. My father and mother brought me to this country to escape communism. They cherished our democracy and were intensely proud to become United States citizens, as was I. I have carried that pride throughout my nearly 20 years of government service and throughout my life. My parents are not here to see this day. Mr. President-elect, Madam Vice President-elect, please know that I will work day and night in the service of our nation to ably lead the men and women of the United States Department of Homeland Security and to bring honor to my parents and to the trust you have placed in me to carry your vision for our country forward. Thank you.
Thank you.
Alejandro Mayorkas, President-elect Joe Biden's nominee to serve as Homeland Security Secretary, talking about his hopes to, quote, advance our proud history as a country of welcome. Well, big changes are expected on the border during a Biden administration. Some thoughts from commentator Walt Rubel.
No, Mexico didn't pay for it. And no, it doesn't stretch for the entire length of the border. But when he leaves office in 2 months, Donald Trump's administration will have completed construction on hundreds of miles of new barrier along the southern border. Rafael Carranza of the Arizona Republic reported last week that the Trump administration has completed work on 400 miles of new barrier in Arizona alone and is expected to add 50 more miles before his term ends. That may come as a surprise to some. During his first 2 years in office, Trump routinely lied about how much progress was being made on the wall. That created a false narrative that some commentators on the left have held to throughout his term. but they were missing what was happening on the border. Things started to pick up after February 2019, when Trump declared a national emergency on the border in order to divert billions of dollars that had been appropriated for defense projects, including at White Sands Missile Range and Holloman Air Force Base. After running into legal roadblocks in Texas early on, the administration shifted its focus to Arizona and New Mexico, newer states where the federal government has free rein on the border. The Homeland Security Department announced at the start of the process that it would not abide by environmental laws or follow the lengthy procedure usually required before the start of any new construction project. In 2018, DHS announced that it was waiving 25 environmental, natural resources, and land management laws so that 20 miles of new barrier could be constructed east of Santa Teresa. That was just one example of environmental and wildlife protection laws being ignored up and down the border, allowing for new construction without oversight. The goal was clearly to get as much done as quickly as possible without concern for the consequences, and then let the next guy figure it out. The next guy will be here soon. Joe Biden has said that he will bring a halt to new construction the moment he takes office. The bigger question is, what should Biden do with the hundreds of miles of barrier hastily erected during the past several months without concern for land, water, or wildlife? Simply tearing down all that Trump has erected may be cathartic, but it doesn't make much sense. Biden should take the time to follow the process that Trump skipped. Bring the scientists and security experts together to determine what is needed and appropriate for each specific region along the border. Then, maybe, we could get back to the real issues of immigration and asylum. That debate has been put on hold for the past 4 years, as the entire discussion has shifted to issues of enforcement and protection. That has to change. With this week's commentary, I'm Walt Rubel.
Walt Rubel's columns appear in the Local Viewpoint section at krwg.org. Rubel's opinions are his own and do not necessarily represent the views of KRWG or NMSU. To environmental news now, and a new study says federal designation of New Mexico's Gila and San Francisco rivers as wild and scenic would increase outdoor recreation spending. The New Mexico News Connection's Roz Brown reports.
The research shows water-related outdoor recreation in the area supports thousands of jobs, which provide $92 million of income. Grant County Commissioner Alicia Edwards has seen firsthand what the rivers provide.
It stimulates activity that is responsible for 4,000 or more jobs in this area, and that is huge. And they're jobs that are probably primarily small businesses.
The M.H. Dutch Salmon Greater Gila Wild and Scenic River Act is currently before the U.S. Senate. It would include the Gila and San Francisco in the National Wild and Scenic Rivers System. Axi Navas with the Office of Outdoor Recreation in New Mexico says support from communities for the legislation has been resounding, from tribes to sportsmen and women to veterans, landowners, small business owners, ranchers, and conservation groups.
I'd say that access to these clean, protected places, and specifically in this case, we're talking about the waters that New Mexico is so proud of, these rivers, that translates to higher quality of life for the areas.
Navas says it also translates to people wanting to move to the area and raise families. Edwards agrees and says a wild and scenic designation would help diversify the economy, which, in addition to tourism and recreation, includes ranching, farming, and mining.
Studies show across the country that recreation areas or cultural areas that become national monuments or wild and scenic increase visitors up to 30%.
The new study was conducted by Southwick and Associates and commissioned by the Pew Charitable Trust. Report authors base their calculations on a recent survey of households in New Mexico and Arizona, as well as data from 2017. Support for this reporting was provided by the Pew Charitable Trust. This is Roz Brown, New Mexico News Connection.
On the Health Watch this week, an ongoing campaign to educate New Mexicans on a genetic disease that affects many in our state is underway. Anthony Moreno spoke with members of the Baca Family Historical Project to find out more.
Cerebral cavernous angioma is an abnormal blood vessel in the brain that may lead to stroke symptoms in children and adults. This disease is found in high rates in Hispanic families, many in New Mexico, and is also known as common Hispanic mutation. There is a campaign working to educate and connect family members who may be affected by CHM. Please welcome our guests for the program from the Baca Family Historical Project, Nora Chavez, who works in community engagement for the project, and Joyce Gonzalez, a genealogist and Baca family member with the project. Thank you both for taking the time to join us.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you so much.
Nora, I want to start with you. Could you share with us a little bit about the organization and the mission of the organization?
We are a four-year granted project that's been funded through Angioma Alliance, which is a national nonprofit organization. And the program here was to do outreach to throughout the state, but predominantly in rural and frontier areas of New Mexico, to try to identify family descendants of the original settler, Cristobal Baca, who came here in the 1600s. And we've been doing that very successfully, I have to say. And we have identified many, many families who are carriers of the genetic mutation, and also work with them to create a support system so that they have someone to turn to who also has the illness, so that they can get to understand the complications, learn how to work with their doctors, and even to get it identified, which is usually a very, very long experience to try to identify. Of course, now with DNA tests, it's a lot quicker. But again, it's very easy to have symptoms and go on for years and not even know that you carry this genetic mutation.
Joyce, you are a Baca family member, a descendant. Could you share with us how you first became aware of this mutation?
Sure. First of all, I did not know I was a member of the Baca family, but when I started doing my genealogy, probably about 25 years ago, just my own family, personal genealogy, it didn't take too long before I found that I and probably most people in New Mexico come from the Baca family in one way or the other. And so I found my connection, but as far as myself having the illness, my mother, who I inherited it from, had already passed, so I didn't know that. But I started having symptoms that no doctor was able to really figure out what it was. But through persistence and sending my medical records at the time, we're talking 15 years ago, things have changed since then, but to Colorado and then to Arizona, I was able to be identified that I also carried this mutation, and that's where my symptoms were coming from.
Joyce, would you mind sharing with us, if it's all right, some of those symptoms?
Sure, absolutely. I'll start off by saying mine were not the most common symptoms that you see. The most common symptoms are going to be seizures of some type, usually more of a focal seizure, or maybe that you've been told there are a lot of aneurysms in your family, but aneurysms are not hereditary. Or if you have a stroke, but the key there is if you have a stroke before the age of 60, that says maybe this is what you're having. But my symptoms were neurological. I was about 30 years old. I put my arms down on the table for the first time. I noticed symptoms, and between my pinkies and my elbows, I felt as if I had pins and needles being shoved into my arms, or maybe as if my arms were burnt at that point. And again, like I told you, after many, many, many doctor's appointments and many years, to tell you the truth, I was finally diagnosed by a neurosurgeon in Colorado, that what I was having is I was having a bleed in my spinal cord. Oh, wow. That was causing these neurological damages. And by that point, they knew I needed to go in ASAP for surgery. I had that done in Phoenix, Arizona by a well-known neurosurgeon, Dr. Robert Spetzler, because this was a little bit of a complicated surgery. But anyway, this was about 15 years ago. And since then, I really am doing very well. So thank God that I figured this out, because as my neurosurgeon told me, if I in my case did not have it done, and if I had a significant bleed, I would have been left paralyzed from the neck down.
Well, we're certainly glad to hear that you're able to get that taken care of. We have just over 30 seconds left, but Nora, I do want to give you an opportunity to let folks know how they can get in touch with your organization.
BacaFamily.org. You can also give us a call at 505-450-5902. We're more than happy to answer questions. We will help you with develop your family tree and work with you to see that you get tested and identified.
Nora Chavez, Joyce Gonzalez from the Baca Family Historical Project, I want to thank you both for joining us on the program.
Thank you so much.
KRWG News this week. I'm Fred Martino. Thanks for being with us. If you ever miss the show, be sure to check it out anytime in the local radio section at krwg.org. The Las Cruces City Council this week reviewed city police department policies. It's also an issue in the national spotlight, and it continues to cause a lot of controversy. In depth, here's Madison Staten.
Councillor Ioana Bencomo is calling for further discussion surrounding Las Cruces Police Department policies following a recent city council meeting.
We have to be really serious, right, about the kind of tension that exists right now in our community and how do we address that.
The council reviewed various policies as part of the settlement agreement between the city of Las Cruces and the estate of Antonio Valenzuela, who died after being restrained by a city police officer at a traffic stop last February. The presentation noted the police department has already implemented the majority of the suggested policies. This includes a ban on all chokeholds and a requirement for biannual de-escalation training. Lieutenant Jeremy Story says the police department is working to offer more trainings in 2021.
What New Mexico requires for in-service every 2 years is 2 hours of crisis intervention, and we currently provide 8 hours. But in addition to that, some of the things that we've done to look at how we can improve that, because 8 hours every 2 years, I think most of us would agree, is probably not enough. We started to look at how do we actually incorporate de-escalation and make it part of the culture and also make it so that it can be applied under stress.
Bencomo stressed more can be done to help residents feel safe. She says she wants to ensure that police and community relations are healthy.
What I'm hearing from the presentation is that we're good. Like, this is great. The problem with that is that that's not what I hear as a city councilor, right, from the community. It's not what I see. Me, some of these things that were presented today are the floor. Like, they are the floor. They're the bare minimum.
While the department says they are taking steps to support mental health, the presentation suggested requiring officers to submit to an annual mental health exam. According to City Attorney Jennifer Vega Brown, the proposed policy would need to be vetted by the Public Safety Select Committee. During the presentation, Mayor Ken Miyagashima and Councillor Bencomo clashed on the best way to move forward with police policy. While open to a future work session, the mayor suggested meeting privately with city councilors first due to liability concerns.
What I don't want to see is a future lawyer, when they're suing the city, having a snippet of you saying something that is wrong. I'm sorry, I'll be real candid with you. Remember, I served prior to this as, for 3 years, we settled nothing but law enforcement claims. And I'm telling you, I've seen that happen.
Miyagashima also spoke about the respect he has for the officers of the Las Cruces Police Department.
You know, I've been with the city so long that I think of our police officers as my sons and daughters. I'm old enough to be there, probably their dad. And it's like, hey, you know what? Our guys don't do anything wrong. It's your guys. It's your department that does. But I know once in a while our people will mess up. But the fact of the remains is they put their lives on the line for us every day. Every day. I mean, the stuff they deal with.
Bencomo echoed those sentiments of respect while emphasizing the importance of looking further into current police policies.
It is not a hard lift. It's about accountability and people wanting to feel safe. I think you want to feel safe in your community. I want to feel safe in my community, and we should all have that.
For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
In focus on KRWG News this week, we continue our conversation with New Mexico U.S. Senator Tom Udall as he completes his time in the Senate. Congressman Ben Ray Lujan will take office in the seat in January. For this segment, we begin with a conversation about President Donald Trump's comments after the election.
He called the election a, quote, fraud,
And he characterized efforts to count all of the votes as an attempt to disenfranchise, that was his word, voters. What was your reaction to this?
Very, very sad. There's absolutely no evidence of fraud. The votes in the states, which are run by states, you have secretaries of state and county clerks who work under them. Everybody's very familiar with our system in New Mexico. The county clerks count it all up, then they send it up to the secretary of state, and then she certifies it. And every state is going through that. So by the end of this month, you will have the same things we're seeing on the television, more or less, the figures right now, which means that it has been an overwhelming victory for Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. And so what's supposed to happen then? Normally what happens within 24 hours is money's released from the federal government to the president-elect and the vice president-elect to start setting up a transition, to start taking over, to allow facilitation of calls with foreign governments, to collect the books, the transition books that are there. Apparently, Trump has ordered the General Services Department to not help in any way. And this is something that's extraordinary. It's unprecedented, as far as I know, anything like that. And so we're still in the process of seeing some very destructive behavior rather than something that's more along the line of respecting democracy, respecting the transition of power.
Okay, well, we will certainly be following that and hope for a quick resolution as the Biden transition continues. I want to ask you, of course, about another election outcome. Benray Lujan will take your seat in the Senate. What is your advice as he moves from the House to this role?
Yeah, I've had a number of conversations with him. In fact, I spoke with him today. He was on our caucus call today, where the senators meet. We had an election today within our caucus. He participated in that to elect our leadership. So he's hit the ground running here, which I knew he would. I mean, he's been in the leadership in the House. He's been in the House since 2008. Here we are 12 years later, and he's moving up and getting promoted to the Senate. I really respect him as a legislator. I think he's a wonderful New Mexico leader. I really admire our family that work together. My father lived many years in New Mexico, and he got to know Ben Ray's father, Speaker Lujan, and they just always had a good relationship. So this is a political family, the Lujan family, that has deep roots in New Mexico. And I think he's going to be an excellent leader in the United States Senate for New Mexico. And he'll probably follow the tradition of people like Senator Dennis Chavez and Senator Bingaman and others that were very bipartisan and pulled people together and did everything they could to pull us together and move us forward together, which is what we really need at this time. We need a lot of healing, in my opinion.
Yeah. Of course, a bright spot for Democrats, but Democrats did not pick up as many seats in the Senate as they had hoped. What went wrong?
Well, I think that one of the things that I've learned in looking at elections is not to condemn the other side. These are our friends and neighbors. These are Americans that are concerned about things. We're at a point in our country right now of very deep polarization. I think a lot of that polarization comes from the inequalities, and especially those inequalities that have been exposed as a result of this pandemic and COVID-19. We see healthcare disparities. We see disparities in terms of working and wages and things like that. And so that draws these lines. And so that's why I say our job really as leaders is to try to find the common ground, move forward. Each side should know it's not going to get everything that it wants, but it should be satisfied when they get enough that's common ground and they can move forward and then come back to the issues again. So that's what I hope happens here.
How about the 2nd District Congressional race? While Democrats were very successful in New Mexico, Representative Xochitl Torres Small failed to keep her seat after just one term.
Yeah. Well, since the history of that seat, I've followed this in New Mexico politics for a long time. There have only been 3 Democrats in the whole history of that southern seat. So one thing we know for sure is that it's a very conservative seat. And that's where the president got the highest turnout. We know that she did very well in the previous election, but this time around against the same opponent, she didn't do as well. But let me just say one thing about Xochitl Torres Small. She ran what I thought was a very, very good campaign. I didn't see any flaws in terms of how she campaigned, how she debated, how she spent her money from that side. But Yvette Harrell ran a good campaign too, and she benefited by all that presidential turnout. So I think Xochitl Torres Small has a great future. I think you may see her surface in terms of running for attorney general. If she wanted to get something in the Biden administration, I think she would have an opportunity there too.
Okay, well, we will watch for that. I'm going to be talking with her, as a matter of fact, later this week, and look forward to that. I want to move to your career, Senator, before we get tight on time, to give you a chance to talk about what you would say has been your biggest accomplishment during your time in the Senate.
You bet. Well, first of all, I would start with all my work on appropriations to really bring, as they say, bring the bacon home to New Mexico, working in terms of public lands, our military bases, the national laboratories. Those are institutions that are tremendously important to New Mexico and have been important and a growing factor since World War II. And we've seen senators in the past that have done the same thing. And we all work together on that kind of building of New Mexico, having a good, strong government sector. But the most interesting thing in the legislation, and much of this was very bipartisan, I passed a major environmental law. Some environmentalists here in Washington called it the biggest environmental achievement in legislation in 25 years, and it was on the issue of toxic chemicals. We don't want our children to have toxic chemicals in the food they eat and air they breathe, in their water. And so we took a law which was completely broken. We stood it back up, and it's the strongest law on toxic chemicals in the whole world. But this administration has really not implemented it well. And there's some wonderful people that are stepping forward to go into the Biden administration to do good implementation. So I'm excited about that. One of the other things is the Great American Outdoors Act. That's the Land and Water Conservation Fund, which my father worked with Congress and started in the 1960s. That Land and Water Conservation Fund, the original dream of the law was to have $900 million a year be spent at the state and local and federal level to create parks, wildlife refuges, grow our great outdoors. And we've finally done that. And so I've been working on that for 22 years since I've been back here. And that was a great achievement. And it actually happened under President Trump. He was trying to cut Land and Water Conservation Fund for so many years, but he turned around and he signed the bill there in the White House. So that was something that I was very, very proud of. And there are many, many other things. It's hard when you jump in and say, what was your biggest accomplishment? But Those are some of them there, and I'm really, really honored to serve New Mexico and to have served New Mexico for the last 30 years. And like I said, I look forward to serving New Mexico in any capacity I can in the future.
Okay. Well, along with being happy about those accomplishments, I'm sure in the time that you've been in the Senate that there have been disappointments. What would you say is your biggest disappointment, the legislation Sure. that didn't pass, that you Yeah. wanted to pass?
Yeah, there are some very big disappointments, but let me pick one here. We're losing trust in government. Since the 1950s and 60s, we've seen the complete erosion of trust in our governmental institutions in the House and the Senate and even the presidency. And so you ask yourself, well, why has that happened? One of the reasons is the way we run campaigns. You know, nobody else would advertise themselves by tearing down the system and running really negative things about your opponent. And we're seeing so much money in that effort. I think that has discouraged people. I think people look at the federal government and say, what is it doing for us? What have they done for me lately? And their answer is their families aren't better off. Many families in New Mexico tell me they don't think their children will be able to do as well as them. So I've been a reformer on something called the For the People Act, which is to completely reform our electoral system with all the big money, the corporate money, all these, the dark money, the gerrymandering, the very bad government ethics laws that the Trump administration has been taking advantage of, all of those kinds of things. And it's a major reform package. It passed the House of Representatives. It was the first bill on Speaker Pelosi's agenda, and it came over to the Senate and it went into Mitch McConnell's graveyard. But it's a good piece of legislation. And for the first time in history, with all the work I've done for 22 years on this issue, every single Democrat in the Senate and in the House has supported this legislation with either a vote or they're a sponsor of the legislation. So it's a big disappointment that it hasn't passed, but we have a new Senate coming up and a new House taking over January 3rd, and we'll see what happens. I'm sure it'll still be the top of everybody's list.
Well, and speaking of changes, of course, one of the new senators will be Mark Kelly from Arizona. At the time of this taping, it appears that Arizona also went with Joe Biden for president. News organizations have called the state for Joe Biden. A huge transformation for a state that was solidly in Republican hands for many, many years.
Yeah, and you know, it's I think it goes back to 1948 that we have won Arizona, Colorado, New Mexico, and we've elected so many senators. So I know Mark Kelly. I served in the House of Representatives with his wife, Gabby Giffords. I had a good congratulatory call with him and told him I think he's going to be great in the Senate. It's been a long time since Arizona has had two Democratic senators. So that's something very encouraging to see the West, the battleground states of the West. Let's include Nevada in there too, and see how the Democrats have been building and doing a better job. But one of the things that I think we need to remember is the rural areas of this country are hurting. They aren't connected with us. They don't have broadband. We need to invest so that everybody in America is connected, and that will really boost our economy in tremendous ways. And you know, the people living in those rural areas, they're so hardworking, they got great values, and there's nothing to hold them back if we get them connected.
Did you see, Senator, any particular lessons in Arizona that Democrats could take to Texas, Florida, other states that have seen progress but still have difficulty in statewide elections electing progressive candidates?
Yes. One of the things that I've seen is that Democrats are very good in Arizona and have been of reaching out to these rural areas and having a message, a unifying message. And by doing that, what happens is they first capture local government and then state government, and then they end up taking over some of these federal government seats. That's happening in Texas right now. If you look at the cities in Texas, we're seeing dramatic growth. Same thing in Georgia and Florida.
I'm glad you mentioned the rural areas, because when you do look at election results all over the country, analysts say that really what we are seeing here is an urban, suburban, and rural divide. And I last week had a chance to talk to a reporter who went across about 900 miles of the Mountain West and talked to people in rural areas. And one of the things he determined, a commonality, was that most of the people that he talked to in rural areas were Trump supporters, and they also had this in common. They got most of their news from Fox News on cable and from social media. You've talked about the press before. I know you're in your time in the Senate, and the fact that this is really important to a functioning democracy. People can't just get information from those sources and be well informed about what's happening.
Well, you're absolutely right. And there are a couple of trends here that are very disturbing. The other part of it first that you didn't mention is talk radio.
Yeah.
If you look at rural areas and where they get their news over the radio, there's been a consolidation of stations. And it's very, very conservative for the most part, if you look at all of the country. We used to have what was called a fairness doctrine. So if you had a person like Rush Limbaugh going on for an hour, they had an obligation to be objective and be fair and put on the other side. They no longer have that obligation and are taking advantage of it. We're seeing media consolidation, so people don't have as many places to look out into the rural areas. And I really think we need to take a good hard look at this in the Biden administration as to what's happening with this monopolization of the media. We know for sure that big corporations are buying media, and then they're laying off all these good reporters. They're treating the purchase of a station as a profit center rather than taking care of the American people and giving them the best information on the issues before them. And that, to me, is very disturbing.
Okay, well, we only have about a minute left, but I want to get to this point because it's probably going to be a narrative over the next year. Joe Biden, as you know, has talked a lot about his success in working across the aisle in the Senate and as vice president. What are the chances this can be accomplished again, at least in some way?
I think it's very good having Joe Biden as president. I really believe, and that's the way I've tried to behave every day here. If I have an issue that I believe New Mexicans are concerned about, or if it's a big national or international issue where we have to move forward, like global warming, I go to my Republican friends and understand their differences and say, isn't there something we can work on to move the ball forward? It may be small, but let's move the ball forward and then maybe come back and tackle this again. And that's the kind of president he's going to be, is really, really work on bringing people together. There's some wonderful stories about when he was the vice president making calls to Leader McConnell, negotiating agreements, doing everything he could to try to move the Obama-Biden agenda there in the White House. And so I really look forward to him returning to the White House as president and bringing that attitude.
Well, Senator, as always, it's been a delight talking with you. Congratulations as you end your time in the Senate, and I'm sure we look forward to more discussions in the future, because you've said you're not retiring. You're going to be doing other things.
That's right. That's right. And I'm happy to come back for interviews. Great to see you.
Great to see you again. Take care.
Thank you.
If you missed any of our conversation with U.S. Senator Tom Udall, you can find it on the Newsmakers page in the local TV section at krwg.org. That's where you will also find our conversation with Representative Xochitl Torres-Small. Udall and Torres-Small are both talking about the need for a second federal stimulus package, something that so far has seemed unlikely. Well, across New Mexico, COVID-19 has led to increased hospitalizations and deaths, in addition to economic distress. And a planning group for end-of-life decisions wants Hispanics to use the health crisis to make those end-of-life choices a priority. The New Mexico News Connection's Roz Brown reports.
Many of us fail to make known our end-of-life choices before a health crisis occurs, and with COVID-19 upon us, those decisions are even more important. Now, a nonprofit has stepped up to help Hispanics navigate their options. The bilingual campaign, initiated by the group Compassion and Choices, is encouraging end-of-life conversations. Maria Otero is the group's national constituency manager and says the COVID-19 pandemic has highlighted the disparities in health experienced by communities of color.
We are essential workers. We have many workers, the restaurant industry or our farm workers. And just because of that, we are exposed to these virus.
Compassion and Choices has assembled a free bilingual COVID-19 toolkit, which is available online at compassionandchoices.org. Latinos make up 25% of the deaths from COVID-19, even though they're only 18% of the population. Patricia Gonzalez-Portillo with Compassion and Choices says where you live, availability of healthcare, and lifestyle are all factors in the severity of illness in Hispanic communities.
We can catch this horrible virus that could kill us. Are we going to wait till that happens before we have the conversation with our family about what I want in case I die from this illness?
Because Hispanics are less likely than whites to have health insurance, Otero says it reduces their ability and willingness to seek treatment. She adds that cultural differences can also play a part.
There's not a word in Spanish about advance directives. We don't have a word for hospice. So often we are perceived like we are not very assertive to what we want at the end of life.
American groups are working with the Mexican consulate's Ventanillas de Salud, or Windows of Health program, to help Latino and Hispanics navigate end-of-life conversations. This is Roz Brown, New Mexico News Connection.
Finally this week, President-elect Joe Biden says no more border wall will be built under his administration. Meanwhile, the Trump administration continues to build and acquire land along the U.S.-Mexico border. Texas Public Radio's Reynaldo Leaños Jr. reports one of those areas is a world-famous bird sanctuary in the Rio Grande Valley.
There's a dove on the ground.
Oh, good.
A group of birders are gathered today on a Friday morning at a birding preserve in Salineño in Starr County. The birders are sitting on lawn chairs and they're looking around with their binoculars at the trees that surround them. Thousands of birders visit here every year.
Well, we get up in the morning and we put out the bird food and the water and just make sure that we're ready to open the gate at 8 o'clock. And then we welcome in the guests and make sure that they see all the different birds that are coming and going.
That's Mike Emenacker. He's one of the volunteers at the birding sanctuary and lives on the property. He says he was in disbelief when he heard the news that the 2.5-acre birding sanctuary, which belongs to the Valley Land Fund, was going to be sold to the federal government for a border wall project.
We were led to believe that we were going to be open for the season, but we never had any communication from Valley Land Fund. It was just one of those things that, you know, personally, I think it was pretty shady the whole way it happened, and really disappointed that the Valley Land Fund didn't have the decency to come talk to us face to face.
U.S. Customs and Border Protection confirmed in a statement to TPR on Friday that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers acquired the tract of land for a CBP enforcement zone. The statement also said that the offer to sell was signed voluntarily. Deborah Lee Rodriguez is the executive director of the Valley Land Fund. She says CBP's statement was premature.
I am the type of individual that truly believes that it wasn't fully executed, that although there was an agreement to accept, there was still a process that we would have to go through thereafter in order to officially convey the land over to the U.S. government.
When news got out about the Valley Land Fund's 11-to-1 board decision to accept an offer to sell, environmentalists, birders, and locals took to social media to express their frustration. One of those people was Tiffany Kirsten. She's on the board of the Friends of the Wildlife Corridor, an organization dedicated to protecting habitat in the region.
It's infinitely disappointing to me that Valley Land Fund didn't decide to look into selling to another conservation organization before just turning it over to the government. If they didn't want to fight the court battle, then that's fine, but give it to someone else who is willing to fight that battle.
Kirsten and others felt that the Valley Land Fund had sold out and was not protecting the land. Rodriguez says they had pushed back against the federal government for months, and they declined several offers. Fast forward to later this fall, Rodriguez says she recalls a conversation she had with the government, asking if they could further delay because of the presidential election.
I mean, is there a possible way that you can kind of just shuffle us under some paperwork and look the other way? I mean, they reminded me, look, we've been working with you since January and we've come 10 months down the line. I guess at that point in time, it was told to us, you either agree to this or we're going to condemn your property.
That's when they decided to enter into an agreement with the government.
Some people may say, well, we should have never been in this position. Why would you allow them to come on your piece of property? I really believe the reason we truly allowed that to happen was because we were confident that they were going to see the value of this piece of property and for what it was, and that we were going to supply them with the information that would give them a reason to go back and say, this is not the place where we should put this.
She says any money they would have received from the selling of the land would have gone back into conservation. Following community backlash, they ended up rescinding any and all offers with the federal government.
I think what we have learned is if there is any land currently owned by Valley Land Fund that has the ability for public use, then we need to go to our public and to our community and ask what they would like for us to do. I keep going back to the 2.5 acres, right? We're such a small little dot on a very big stage. We had no idea that the outcry was going to be this loud.
CBP says the government has not received any formal communication regarding the board's decision to rescind the offer. Rodriguez says she's been in communication with the Army Corps of Engineers. She also says they're gearing up for the upcoming condemnation lawsuit from the federal government and hopes the community will support them through this process. I'm Reynaldo Lianos Jr. in Salineño.
That's KRWG News This Week. I'm Fred Martino. Enjoy the rest of your weekend. Broadcasting from New Mexico State University, this is KRWG Las Cruces and KRXG Silver City.